Mike,
Yes.
so good to talk to you today. I'm going to start off with something really general, which is, you know, tell me where you were born.
Okay, I was born in Fort Sam in a TB hospital. My birth mom was in a hospital there in 1954.
And she was in there obviously because she had tuberculosis. So what happened? How did that play out?
Well, apparently the authorities didn't want to keep me, or didn't want my mother to keep me because she was in the hospital. So they were probably going to give me up to adoption. Because my mother said in later years when I talked to her, they actually put a sheet over her head so she didn't even see me when I was born. But I was lucky enough that I had an uncle, my birth mom's brother, had just recently married, and they found out about me being born, and they somehow were able to get a hold of the people in Fort Coupal. Because there was no telephones back then, just radiograms.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were able to send a message that they wanted to adopt me, and that's what happened. I got bused to PA, and then I went by mail plane to Isla La Crosse. And that's, I ended up growing up in Isla La Crosse in an island called Sandy Point.
With your uncle and auntie?
Yes, well, yeah, I've always known them as my parents, my mom and dad. They raised me since birth. And but yes, he was actually my uncle. And so I was very fortunate to have been, you know, raised in Isla La Crosse as opposed to having been lost somewhere in a system. I don't know where I would have been.
That's for sure.
Happened. I'm fortunate that way.
Yes, very fortunate. Before we talk more about your mom and dad, could we talk a little bit more about your birth mom's life and her situation? And did you have any siblings from her?
Well, yeah, my birth mom was Albina, and she actually married a Norwegian immigrant, a trapper, early in life. And I think Tony Swanson was in his 40s, and my mom was probably just in her late teens.
Mm-hmm.
She got married to him, and they had three girls, my sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony used to work for mink ranchers around Isla La Crosse, and one winter morning, 40 below or whatever it was, I guess,
mm-hmm.
he was trying to make a fire, and he inadvertently threw gasoline into the stove, and it exploded. He died in the fire, including one of my sisters, Doreen.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was able to run out with two of her girls under each arm.
Wow.
To get away. And so it was a very traumatic experience for her.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the two remaining sisters, Yvonne and Caroline, she gave them up to family. Yvonne was raised in Isla La Crosse, but I didn't even know that as a kid, really. And Caroline was adopted and raised in Meadow Lake, and I really didn't know much about that until later in life either. And,
when did you find that out?
Oh, I was probably a young adult when I started finding out all this stuff. Because back in those days, adoptions weren't discussed much. There was no openness. Nobody was told anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my mom relocated to Meadow Lake and married there and worked and whatnot, I guess, around Meadow Lake. And there was 13 of us all together anyway. She ended up having 13 children.
And you mentioned earlier that you talked to her later in life. What was it like seeing her and not knowing necessarily who she was at first?
Well, as a kid, yeah. I was actually lucky. I grew up with one of my brothers. We didn't really know each other as my brother. He was almost like an uncle because my grandma raised him.
Uh-huh.
His name was Lili. his nickname, and John was his first name, but he died in a hunting accident early in life. And anyway, with my mother not knowing who she was, this woman used to come to Isle of La Crosse every Christmas time, and I used to run away from her because I didn't know who she was, and she'd try and come and grab me to kiss me. And of course, she was always, you know, drinking. And
yeah.
I didn't grow up in a family where there was alcohol or much of it. And
uh-huh.
So it was difficult to grasp all that stuff when I became a young adult and found out that she was actually my mom. It took us a while to get over that. But, I mean, now I still talk to her. She's 92 years old now. My adopted parents have both since passed away. But my birth mom is still alive today, and we actually just went and seen her just a few weeks ago.
And how's she doing?
Well, she's doing okay for 92 years old. She's actually just moving into a home now. She's been living by herself all these years.
Uh-huh. Wow. Now, let's shift a little bit to your parents. What you remember from your early childhood. What did they do for a living?
Well, my dad was a trapper, a hunter, a commercial fisherman. Plus, he worked for mink ranchers, mostly Osland and Deep River. And my mom basically was a homemaker. There was not much employment in those days. So mm-hmm. she basically looked after the house and me.
Right, right. In that, are there special memories that you have from your early childhood with your mom and dad?
Well, yeah, we used to travel. We'd go berry picking in the summertime. Each berries have their season. Like, first thing we'd be picking the strawberries, and then you go into Saskatoon's raspberries, and then blueberries, and at the end of the towards the fall, then we'd be picking cranberries. And then we used to travel up the lake in the summer when my dad was commercial fishing, and our whole communities would travel to Halfway Lake, and people would have their fishing camps, and we'd pretty much stay there for a couple months while our parents were fishing, while my dad and us kids, we'd just swim and play around and have a good time.
Nice. And what about in the winter time?
Well, before we went to school, I guess we stayed home and we used to toboggan. Everybody had a dog team or a team of horses. That's pretty much how we traveled in the winter. There was no skidoos yet. We mm-hmm. didn't have roads where we grew up, and we still don't have roads there. It's across the lake from Isle of La Crosse, about mm-hmm. 5.5 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So, but hockey was a big thing. Once we got back into school, we attended the Isle of La Crosse boarding school, they call it. It's basically a residential school, no different than the one in Beauval, which was a sister residence.
Okay. And how old were you when you started to go to school?
Most of us started school at grade one, and usually we were 7 years old. Our parents were very reluctant to let us go to school any sooner. So most of us were 7 years old, into grade one, and 99% only spoke Cree, Mi'kmaq Cree. So nobody basically spoke any English when they first went to school. It was very difficult.
Tell me a little bit more about that, getting to school and being expected to speak English and not knowing that language.
Well, the boarding school in Isle of La Crosse was run by the Catholic Church, excuse me, the diocese from DePauw.
Uh-huh.
And, well, the nuns and the priests all spoke French, and we all spoke Cree, but we were expected to speak English. And if you got caught speaking Cree, then you got disciplined.
Uh-huh.
Because it would be could be a strapping or a lecture. The first couple of times, you probably get a lecture and a good scolding. And then beyond that, then they would start giving you the strap.
And now, let's back up just a little bit. You said that your parents were reluctant and that parents in general were reluctant to send their kids to school before the age of 7. Do you remember looking forward to going to school? And is there, you know, what was your parents thinking in not wanting to send you earlier than 7 years old?
I really didn't know what school was, so I really don't know how to answer that. I didn't really want to go because, I mean, we had to stay in a residence. Our parents lived across the lake, and for us to go to school, we had to stay at the boarding school. And none of us really wanted to. Our grandparents eventually did move to town, probably because of my grandfather's health.
Okay.
And we did stay with them 1 year there, but, I mean, it was pretty tough for grandparents at, you know, 60 years old to look after 10 grandkids, and we were all from the age of 7 to whatever, 10, 12.
Yeah, yeah.
And we all ended up back in the residential school.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess I want to talk a little bit about your parents and your grandparents. Did they... obviously, they lived on the land, I think you told me before that your mother was a really good baker. But what about your grandparents and your parents? What were their views on life and politics and religion have been at the time?
Well, growing up in Sandy Point, my grandfather was Ambrose Moore, and my grandmother was Mary Jane, which were my mom's parents.
Mm-hmm.
And dad, being a DeRocher, was accepted into the family, of course. And we, you know, got a house built there, a little house. Everybody had a little house. But my grandfather had big gardens, and he also had a couple of dairy cows and a bull, and... he did try raising chickens as well, and we did have eggs for a couple of years. We'd have fresh eggs and stuff. But the weasels got the best part of the chicken coop.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather also had contracts with the mission, because back in the late 50s and 60s, the mission, the Roman Catholic mission, ran the hospital, the convent, a girl's residence, a boy's residence.
Uh-huh.
House, the church, and everything was heated by wood.
Uh-huh.
So various families, basically from across the lake, a whole bunch of us Métis families lived in various locations on La Crosse Lake. They'd have these contracts to cut wood for the mission.
Uh-huh.
And this was done in the spring when the sap was running good for poplar trees.
Uh-huh.
And so I remember helping out as a kid. They cut these 3-foot-length poplar aspen.
Mm-hmm.
And then they split them in half. And then us boys would stack them up. And they had to be, I think they were 4 feet high and 8 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would dry there all summer, you know. And then in the next winter, the mission would come, with one of the Oblate brothers would come with a caterpillar and a train. Of sleighs, and then they'd haul the wood back to town.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one thing. And then the other reason why my grandpa had a big garden too was because they also sold vegetables to the mission.
Ah.
Potatoes and stuff like that. And there was several families that did that. William Dunoff from across the way in Beaver River. People lived all over the lake. And we were pretty much self-sufficient. There was no welfare back then, so people found any way they could make a few bucks, because you had to buy sugar and flour and stuff like that. But otherwise, we lived off the land, fishing, hunting, birds, rabbits, you know. We were never short of food.
And your dad, he had a business, didn't he?
Well, Dad was a commercial fisherman, and he also trapped, and then he was a good hunter. And he was also a good worker with mink, skinning and feeding, looking after mink. So he was sought after by mink ranchers to work. And so we did spend quite a bit of time in a place called Deep River where my dad would work and stuff. And then in the summertime back in Sandy Point, my other grandma, my dad's mom, she would come and spend this couple months with us, and she'd stay in a tent. And what she did all summer was she used to make moose hides for my dad, because my dad would kill, you know, a few moose over the winter, and then he'd keep the hide.
Yeah.
And then my grandmother would come over the summer, and she would make moose hide, and I used to help her do that. It was a lot of work.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. I've tried to do that before myself. It is a lot of work. Wow. Yeah. So she was doing that, hey, for the family?
Mm-hmm. And wow. It was really interesting, too, with my grandma Monique. See, my dad lost his father really early. My grandfather, Victor, died before I was born. And then my grandmother remarried.
Mm-hmm.
And she remarried into an abusive situation, and she left her husband, which was a no-no in the Catholic Church. So my grandmother was actually kicked out of the church for a lot of years. It was only in the, probably in the late 90s, she finally was allowed back in to go to church. But she was only the first woman to actually have the courage to leave her husband.
Yes.
Yeah. And
especially back then.
Yeah. And she grew up by herself, worked alone, and raised my brother Lily. And then he died when he was 21. So it took a heavy toll on grandma. But my grandma lived till she was, 92 or 94. She lived to be old.
Wow.
So, she had a lot of stories.
Yeah. Sounds like it. And what about, you talked about Lily a couple times. Tell me about him.
My brother?
Yeah.
Lily, yeah. He was blonde and gray blue eyes. Obviously, he had a non-native dad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was interesting. We grew up together, but we didn't really know we were brothers until we were, you know, probably 9, 10 years old. So it was interesting. He lived in town with grandma, so, I mean, we really didn't hang out together much unless he was out in Sandy Point in the summertime.
Yeah.
Because he lived with grandma. He didn't go to the residential school. We did. And we couldn't visit nobody. They couldn't visit us either, so.
Right.
We only saw each other in the summer or at school.
Okay. So tell me, generally speaking, when it comes to sort of your parents' religious background and your family's religious background, what would you say?
It was very strict Roman Catholic. Very
Just
strict.
Elaborate maybe a little bit on that.
Well, basically, the church ran the town. So, I mean, you went to church on Sunday. We were altar boys from when we were little kids. And so even in the residential school, we'd get up early in the morning, go to church and serve Mass, and then we'd go have breakfast and go to school. Very strict. We didn't miss Easter, Christmas, all the special religious functions, we were always part of it. There was no missing, no excuse to miss.
Sounds pretty regimented.
It was very strict.
And how did that compare to that free lifestyle that you had before that?
Well, I don't know, because the church has been in La Crosse since 1776. So, I mean, it's generations. I have no clue what free lifestyle they had before that. I couldn't tell you. It's been ingrained Roman Catholic from the late 1700s to now. So.
And were all the kids at the school mitzvahs?
Yes, all the students that came to La Crosse from the Lodge, Turner Lake, Patchenac, Wollaston, Big River, Dory Lake, Sled Lake, Dillon, everywhere. They were all non-status Métis, sort of half-breed.
Okay.
All our treaty cousins went to Beauval, to the treaty school there. But it was run by the same outfit.
Okay.
The same education system, the Saskatchewan education was in charge of education. In Beauval, it was a federal school, so the feds looked after that. In our case, it was more run by the church. So the ongoing issue now is, who is responsible, the federal government, the province, or the church? Well, all of them, in my argument.
Right, right.
They all had a piece of it.
Yes, and when you were at Isle of La Crosse School, I think you told me it was Rossignol School, right?
Yeah, Rossignol School, yes.
Right. Did you ever get to go home, or did you have to stay there the whole time?
We were lucky because our community where we lived, Sandy Point, is like 5.5 miles. One of our parents or uncles were able to come and sign us out on Fridays, and we'd go home some weekends, not every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But most times we were able to. Same thing when we were in Deep River, the mink rancher would come into shop every Friday, and they had three of their kids were actually in our residence with us too, from Deep River,
mm-hmm.
White Pit.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to go home every weekend, so that was pretty good. But
and what about the other kids?
Other kids, some of them never went home till the next June, end of the school year, for summer holidays.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And, so thinking back to those early years at school, what was your impression of the teachers?
Well, the nuns were mean. There was always a few nuns teaching. I went to a number of principals. Most of them were good, except for one, Henbury. He was pretty nasty.
Mm-hmm.
He was a British from England. Most of our teachers were good, I think. They had to be Catholic.
Yeah.
They had to make certain agreements, verbal or otherwise, I don't know, that they couldn't mingle with the community, you know.
Right.
They lived in chain link fence yards. We were not allowed to bother them. But we did eventually used to sneak in and go visit some of the teachers, you know, as young kids.
Yeah.
We enjoyed kids, you know, especially the female teachers.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were very friendly, but even them, the single female teachers, were prohibited from hanging out with the community boys, and if they got caught, they were fired. So actually, one of my teachers was fired because she got caught with one of the local boys.
So there was a pretty strict segregation there between the white, basically white educators and Métis students.
Yeah, there was a big difference, yes, between the Aboriginal community and the non-native people. There's a lot of rules that were established by the church as to who could, you know, what they could do and who they could hang out with, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Socializing.
And did you have any favorite teachers that you liked that were nice?
Well, Samuelski was not a bad teacher. I actually enjoyed him. Cam Joseph, I actually enjoyed him. Cam Joseph, he was a social, sciences teacher.
Uh-huh.
And I love science. So
mm-hmm.
pretty much that's the only ones, because I only went there to grade 9 and then I was out.
And how would you describe yourself as a student?
Well, I was pretty bright. I was usually in the top 3 or 4. I don't want to brag that I was number one. I don't think I ever was.
But
I was well read.
Yeah, I got that impression from your website that you like to do a lot of reading and that you were quite studious.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was well read. My experience living in a mink ranch, of course, the mink rancher had 3 kids and they had all their books. Vopsy Twins, The Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, Tom Swift, Life Magazine, Time. I read all that stuff. I was very well read, so I think a lot of times the teachers were quite surprised as how much I knew about current events. You know, considering we lived in a bush, there was no TV. All we had for news was a little transistor radio. There's no telephones, nothing.
Right.
So I got to read news. I even remember stuff like John F. Kennedy's assassination. I remember that very well because it was all over Life magazine. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that I was a few years too young for that, I guess, was Woodstock was also a big thing to read about in Life magazine. It was quite eye-opening to see that.
Uh-huh. And do you find that that helped you at school?
Oh, for sure, yes. Oh, definitely. The reading part especially.
Did it ever get you into any trouble?
No.
No?
No, well, towards the end, yes.
How so?
When we got expelled from school because we were demonstrating, and that was, I think, having watched too many and read too much about the Vietnam protest they had in the States in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
So I ended up creating posters at the residential school and gave them to three cousins of mine, and we were parading around there displaying these posters of these child abusers, that one of them was a supervisor and then the other was a clergy. Not realizing what we were doing, I guess I was 15 years old, but we got expelled for that.
Wow.
We were protesting abuse.
Right. So you were protesting abuse from the, especially as you said, this, what did you call him again?
The supervisors. We used to call them masters.
Right.
We used to have to call them a master. But they were a supervisor and he was abusing little kids. To us, we didn't think it was acceptable because they were probably like 5, 7 years old, 8 years old.
And what about yourself?
Oh, well, I went through that myself. I mean, it was horrible.
At what age?
Oh, between 4 or 5 years, probably from the age of 8 or 9. I don't remember how back it was until pretty much I was getting into my teens.
So that means that you experienced physical and sexual abuse?
Oh, yes, big time. It was not good. And I think it really picked me up in my life in many ways. Even though I've been successful at what I've done, I've always had trouble with authority. I've never been in jail or even in a drunk tank, but in a lot of my jobs, I used to get in trouble with my bosses because I would end up reacting to authority, right? The things that are being told what to do and whatnot, so... Yeah, that was always my biggest problem throughout my life after that. No matter what kind of work I did, I would always end up getting into some kind of crap because, I don't know, it wasn't good.
Yeah, and obviously you also witnessed this for happening to other students.
Oh, yes. In the residential school at the time we were there, I mean, it was almost as if, what they used to tell us, oh, you got to practice. So when you get older, this is how you will, you know, learn how to be with girls. It was almost like you read about the Greeks and the mythology of Greek boys.
Uh-huh.
That whole concept. It was, I don't know. It was not a good thing.
So I guess when the lights went out at night, you didn't feel safe, like you could sleep.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's when the boys would start creeping around and they end up, you know, crawling into your bed and you're sleeping and you wake up and somebody's bothering you. And you get threatened not to talk or make any noise. So And then that eventually you start doing that yourself when you turn 14, 15.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start doing that amongst your other friends, your other boys.
Yeah.
Like I was saying. It was almost like we were at the practice. But there was no love. There was no hugging in terms of even amongst the kids. Like, you know, being close, not sexually.
Yeah.
But just being as friends.
Yeah.
So growing up as a young adult, I didn't know how to hug.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to date. I actually got in trouble with women a few times when I started going out because we would be out partying and drinking and we'd go to bed and thinking, well, what used to happen to me is we'd be sleeping and next thing you know, somebody's groping around, waking you up, trying to have sex.
Yeah.
Well, I started doing that as a young adult because I thought that's the way you went to bed and had So we'd go to sleep, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night and start getting whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Get myself into some serious trouble. I'm actually lucky I never got charged in some in situations like that. Because, I mean, you would, nowadays you would call that date rape.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you didn't know.
But we didn't know. I had no clue. I mean, it took years. Even when a woman wanted to come out with me a lot of times, I didn't know how to react. I had no you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I was just dumb.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. And do you have any, I hate to ask this question, but do you have any particularly horrible memories that have stuck with you?
Well, not, I think just overall that whole number of years still bothers me in many ways. And I've always made sure I would never do that to any of my kids, my grandkids. I'm always very careful. Because especially nowadays, a lot of stuff happening out there too with child abuse and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always, when I realized I was going to become an abuser myself, I realized how this thing went from being an abused to an abuser.
Yeah, the cycle.
And I hated that.
Mm-hmm.
When I started realizing, oh my God, when am I starting here, you know?
Yeah.
And so on one hand, getting kicked out of the residence for me was a blessing in disguise because I got out of there.
Yeah.
I ended up in the trap line. I started working, making a living. And after that, I always made the intent, because I never drank. I didn't drink till I was 18.
Right. So your life got a lot better then.
For me, it was, yes. I tried to put all that stuff behind me. Every time I did something, I always did my best. So I was a good trapper. Most of the jobs I've done, I've always done a good job.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up pursuing a university degree later on, but after being kicked out of school, how did you continue to pursue your grade 12?
Well, first and 16, I got my trapper's license and started trapping with my dad, and I was a very good trapper, and I did that till I was 20. For some reason, I started feeling sorry for the animals, so I quit trapping and then got a job with at the co-op store. Ovid Desjarlais was the manager.
Mm-hmm.
It was my favorite boss. He's still my favorite boss. He's 97 years old now, and I still call him my favorite boss.
Nice.
But anyway, working for the co-op back then, I was only making probably a dollar or something an hour. And I lived in a tent outside my grandma's little shack in town.
Mm-hmm.
Then my parents moved, because everybody got moved in the latter part of the 70s. All of us people from across the lake eventually all got moved to town. They gave us a new house and stuff like that. So it was almost like a forced relocation. They said, oh, you can't live out here now. The water's no good for you, you know, whatnot. So everybody ended up getting a house. So they had to pay power bill. They had to pay a house mortgage. and you know, all these bills. So
wow.
How did they have to pay for it? Well, there's no jobs. I mean, you can only fish for so much. You can only trap for so much. So people ended up on welfare. That's when welfare started.
Right.
And it was not good.
Yeah.
In ways, because it spoiled the people. People then refused to go to work.
Right.
They just went to the doctor and got a doctor's slip and said, well, I don't have to work, so take it to welfare, and they're on welfare. And it was a good thing for people to get that help, but at the same time, for a lot of people, they gave up and quit working.
I see.
At the other hand, how are they supposed to pay a mortgage? Like
well,
my
yeah.
dad.
Yeah.
My mom was sick with cancer from the 50s, so at least my mom was able to get help from social services because of her illness, and my dad used to have to look after her, so he couldn't leave home for much.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the later years. But I mean, you were living self-sufficient across the lake, had your own house, your own life, your own gardens, you survived on your own, and then all of a sudden the government tells you, well, we got a brand new house here in town for you to move in. But then you got all these bills to pay for.
Yeah, yeah. So that must have actually meant that times were quite tight at that point.
Yeah, and I think for me, the thing with the government was at the time to move the people out of the land, you know.
Yeah.
It's still an ongoing thing. It's still an ongoing problem today back home.
And why did they say they had to, why did they say they had to relocate the community?
Well, they didn't relocate the community. All of us grew up in different locations. If you go on my website and you go to Sandy Point, you'll see some maps I made of
uh-huh.
where people lived, where mink ranches were. You'll find a map of Sandy Point and you'll see all the different houses where our houses were.
Uh-huh.
You can use that freely for your own use.
Okay.
Anyway, so people that lived all over the lake were made to move to town.
And did never gave you a reason?
Well, yeah. I mean, your health.
I see.
Bad water.
I see.
You're better off to live in a nice house here. You got running water. You got a bathroom.
Right.
Back across the lake, we had an outhouse. Water from the lake. So.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the water back then was good.
Yeah.
Today, probably not so good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, For us, most of us, it was to get us off the land because everybody was on the land, and it's still a big issue today because they want to open the land up for forestry and mining and all that stuff. And La Crosse has always been staunch as Métis people to stop that.
Okay.
And we've been successful to a degree, but everybody got moved to town, so nobody lives across the lake now. All we have are little... That land is not even ours. You have to get a lease to have your cabin there. So it's government land. That's supposed to be your land.
And do you still go there ever?
Well, every summer. I mean, that's my home.
Right.
I have a house in La Crosse.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm there every summer. I can barely wait to get there. But who knows with this disease, I might not be able to go anywhere for a few days yet.
Yes, and you mean the COVID-19?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, are they actually selling that land to people who, or leasing the land to people who want cottages?
Well, first of all, you got to have a trapper's license to get a traditional land lease.
Yeah.
So it's for the local people around there. But they are starting to give leases to outsiders. Because now I just recently found a camp that's owned by outsiders that's been on La Crosse Lake for 3 years. Barely nobody knew about it.
Ah.
A fishing camp.
Wow.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
I found that by accident.
Yeah. Well, and you mustn't have been too happy finding it.
Well, no, because we'd like to see that industry to be run by our people, not somebody from Kindersley.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, or
yeah.
Maybe. So.
Well, and,
anyway.
And especially that it's always been such a part of the traditional economy of the region, and it still is the way that you're talking about it.
Well, I remember as a kid growing up, we used to fish anytime we wanted to, go hunting moose. I mean, we wouldn't hunt moose in the spring when the calf, you know, there's going to be calving,
yeah,
things like that. But I mean, people were responsible with what they harvested. We could go shoot a duck, pick duck eggs and stuff like that. And then I remember when they started to develop the north, and I was a teenager, and the resource officers would come to these me, oh yeah, you can still do your fishing, you can do that, we won't molest you that way, you know, you're still free to do. Well, you can't do that anymore. You'll get arrested. All that stuff, even fishing, commercial fishing, of course you need a license, but I mean, to go hunting ducks, you gotta have a duck license. You need to go, you can't pick duck eggs. I mean, these are all traditional things we grew up doing. We'd go harvest eggs and have an egg feast, you know?
Right.
Stuff like that. So, I mean, we're so over-controlled these days, it's not even funny.
Yeah. And I want to get back to that later on when you and I do the third part of this and we talk a little bit more about your adult life. But I want to go back to your early childhood and the people that you grew up with and around. Who was around you as you were growing up? Because it was a pretty small community.
Well, in Sandpoint, I was raised as an only child, so I had my cousins. And then Grandma raised Don, so we called him Uncle Don. We're very close. So I guess your cousins that you grew up with were the closest. So
okay.
My Uncle Leon's kids, Richard, with his name was Sunni. Money in Cree. Peter, and then on the Gardner's side, because old man George Gardner married Adelaide, and my grandpa Ambrose married Mary Jane, and they were sisters.
Okay.
My grandpa's French, and on the Gardner's side, he's English. And they were good buddies, and they trapped together, married sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And they settled in this little island called Sandpoint. That's how it started.
Okay.
And then from those two sisters, there's probably 400 of us now today.
Wow. Wow. Big families, eh?
Yeah. But
and
anyway,
so you even though you were an only child, you were never lonely. You obviously had a lot of people around you all the time.
Yeah, there were a lot of kids on the island. I'd say at any given time, there's probably 20, 30 kids. So we used to play rubber ball a lot in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Sandpoint being a big, long, sandy beach, it's right on the end curve of Isle of Cross Lake. It's part of the Churchill River.
Uh-huh.
So our Sandpoint was a big, long beach. And we spent hours and hours on that every day in the summertime.
Wow.
Boats, swimming, pulling little boats along the shore and whatnot. And in the wintertime, of course, we were across the lake in school. So.
Oh, well, the summer sounded like fun.
Yeah, we hunted lots. We'd go hunting chickens, rabbits, you know, learning hunting skills. We'd learn how to use a canoe and then we'd go pick up mud hen eggs and stuff like that. So it's always something to do.
And tell me a little bit more about the skills that you learned in the bush and growing up and things that you were particularly good at.
Well, you learned to shoot at 22, quite young, probably shooting at rabbits and chickens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then when you got a little older and you're a little stronger, then you got to use a shotgun so you could go hunt ducks and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then for activities as little kids, we used to go pick up blackbird eggs. So we'd be climbing up all these willows in the marsh and stuff and falling off trees, collecting blackbird eggs. And my grandma would cook them for us and we'd have a blackbird egg feast.
Wow.
And, yeah, we used to have a lot of fun. And then I used to make slingshots.
Uh-huh.
And I'd sell them for a quarter to my cousins.
Okay.
I used to make little wooden boats. So, you know, to pull along the shore when we played boats. But
yeah.
We pretend we're fishermen, right? Like our parents.
Of course.
So we'd all have our little boats and we'd run along the shore and we'd, and I made a scow and I was a fish buyer that one summer.
Yeah.
A lot of fun because you had to make up your own games. We had no TV.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'd make, you know, climb up trees. Amazing. Nobody ever got seriously hurt. Tree climbing, trying to play Tarzan, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what about family celebration time of year? Because you were mentioning earlier that you would go home for special celebrations like Christmas and Easter. Tell me a little bit about those occasions.
Well, Easter was a very special religious-wise. There was no alcohol involved in any of the families. It's prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
We're very strict. To this day, I'm not religious per se, kind of superstitious, but to this day, I still honor, because of my elders, I still honor the Good Friday, the Lent.
Yes.
I eat fish every Friday during Lent. It's automatic. I don't even think about it. It just happens.
Uh-huh.
Just the way it was.
Yeah.
So everybody went to church. Us, of course, we were altar boys, so we always were involved in all the high mass, the low mass, all the different masses that were involved in Lent, getting our feet washed and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then at Christmas time, it was the same thing again with the, you know, the birth of Jesus and all that stuff. So we were all involved in all that stuff again and with the church. Midnight mass, we'd travel from across the lake by horses in the middle of the night to go to midnight mass. And then when church was over, whatever it may be, 1:30 in the morning, we'd head back home in the middle of the night. The horses knew where to go. So.
Uh-huh.
Get home at 3-4 in the morning, go to bed, and Christmas Day we'd be able to open our Christmas gifts. There wasn't much back then. We had no Christmas trees, not many.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, not like today, it's so commercialized. Back in those days, I mean, we had a little house, a little two-bedroom house. There was no room for a Christmas tree in there, so.
Right.
We had little small houses, all wood heat. So.
And do you ever remember a favorite Christmas present or birthday present?
Not in particular. I had a battery-powered train 1 year, because being an only child, I was a little spoiled, so.
Yeah.
I had a lot of good gifts, so I don't remember any in particular.
Nice. And what about food-wise at those celebrations? Were there any particular foods that were your favorites or that you always hoped your mom would make?
Well, because we were three of us in our family, we only had chicken. We never had turkey. Like my uncles and my grandma and them, they all had larger families. You know, some had 7-8 kids. So they always had turkey. But us, we only had chicken because there was only three of us.
Uh-huh.
So even to this day now, I still prefer chicken.
Uh-huh.
Like when we have our Christmas dinners now as adults and old-timers now.
Uh-huh.
When we have a Christmas dinner, a lot of times we'll just cook a chicken because I'm just used to that. And then again, right. There's only three of us here now with me and my spouse and our granddaughter.
Right.
And then also, I used to love eating a Red Sucker Bible. And what is a red sucker's mullet? And what
uh-huh.
they do is they chop it from the head down the back and split it open from the back open. Instead, normally you gut a fish from the belly and cut it open.
Yeah.
This way you chop it or cut it from the top. So, you know, cut the head right, you know, split the head in half and then across
uh-huh.
the back.
Uh-huh.
And then you clean the insides out.
Uh-huh.
And then you smoke it.
Oh.
And then and you can close it. And we called it a Bible. I don't know. It's just that's a Red Sucker Bible. It's just a name we've given it as Métis people. I really like that. And then in the spring, I also have my special meal every spring.
What's that?
It's very, very healthy. It's muskrat, smoked muskrat.
Oh.
See, all they eat is healthy, hard food underwater.
Uh-huh.
Everything they eat is vegetable and underwater, and it's very healthy, a lot of heart medicine.
Uh-huh.
So to me, muskrat and beaver are very, very medicinal animals to eat and very healthy. So every spring I at least have anywhere between 2 to 4 muskrat every spring.
I just have.
And I think it's good for your health because I'm still healthy.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely look by the look of your photographs for sure. Now, you mentioned to me that your mom was a good baker. What do you remember about that?
Well, what's amazing about my mom was, okay, she had a brain tumor in 58. I was only 4 years old. She ended up in Saskatoon in the hospital for 6 months going through radiation and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she came home and resumed life as best as she could. She had lost some movement from her left side of her arm and her leg, so she kind of had a limp and she couldn't really use her left arm that well. I mean, she could. But she had an amazing, I would call a photographic memory, because my mom never wrote, could never read, never write.
Uh-huh.
And the mink rancher, Violet Oslin, gave her all these recipes to bake, like lemon meringue, all these different kinds of pies, cakes, you know, cake from scratch.
Uh-huh.
Back in the day, they didn't have cake mix.
Uh-huh.
So cinnamon buns, bread, all that, she could bake. Everything and her recipes were in her head.
Wow.
She was just an amazing baker. I mean, my late cousin Eddie, lived across the way about 3 miles, and he could smell my mom's cooking.
Would it bring him calling?
Yes. Every time my mom was done her baking, Ed would show up, cousin Ed. my mom just loved him.
Awesome.
But unfortunately, he has since passed away too. But honest, and where we lived and where Sucker Point was, it's kind of downwind, kind of from the west.
Yeah.
So as soon as my mom was baking, Edward would smell that. And about a couple hours later, he would show up just when the cinnamon buns were coming out of the oven. My mom would swear he would be there. And he did. I bet you 99 out of 10, he would be there.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, people love mom's baking.
Yeah. And then I wanted to go back to your dad a bit, because I know that the two of you spent quite a bit of time mink hunting. And you told me a story, and I would love for you to tell me that story again, but you told me a story about kind of beating your dad at mink hunting.
Oh, no, trapping.
Oh, trapping, yeah, trapping.
Yeah. Well, I was 16 years old, and we went to Meadow Lake once a year in the fall, towards fall, to get ready for the winter, and we're usually buying clothes and some supplies. You can buy groceries a little bit cheaper in Meadow Lake.
Uh-huh.
And so I asked my dad for $25 because I wanted to buy some Chanel No. 5 perfume. I had read in the paper somewhere that summer Chanel No. 5 was good for a lynx lure, for lynx trapping. So my dad was curious because he didn't believe I was going to buy this $25, which was expensive in those days. This was 1970.
Uh-huh.
He really wanted to know who this girlfriend I had. I said, no, I don't have a girlfriend. I said, it's for my lure. He wouldn't believe me anyway. So anyway, he did give me my money, and I bought my lure and went home with my perfume, and I wanted to give half of it to him. And he said, no, I don't want it. He said, you use it yourself. And then he gave me half of his, we call it pasusan. It's a lure, your trapping lure. So I added my perfume, about a half a bottle, put it into my lure. And then off we went to the trap line that fall. We always went in October, and we would stay there till after freeze up, and we would actually walk home in late November after the lake was frozen.
Mm-hmm.
So off we went, just me and dad. Mom was stayed home, and just dad and I were at our cabin. I forget how many miles, quite a ways away from home.
Uh-huh.
You can't walk. We couldn't walk home from there.
Uh-huh.
So, and we set up our, you know, started walking up our trap lines and setting our traps along. And couple of days later, we go back, and my first trap, I had a silver fox. I couldn't believe it. And then we come back, and then I got two minks that I had trapped side by side. So there I am carrying these two minks because I didn't know how to kill them. My dad could kill a mink with his hands.
Oh, wow.
And then once we started setting our lynx traps, I actually ended up trapping 16 lynx that fall. My dad couldn't believe it. So I actually out-trapped my dad in my first fall. I even snared a big timber wolf.
Oh, wow.
I had set a snare for a deer. We used to snare a deer, and then we'd use some of the deer meat to eat, and then most of it we'd use for bait for wolves and coyotes. And instead of a deer, there was a great big timber wolf. It was taller than I was.
Wow.
My dad couldn't believe it, and it was dead. Like, it's usually pretty tough to snare a wolf, eh? So,
yeah.
No, I was actually very lucky, and I was good at trapping. But for some reason, I ended up quitting when I was 20. I started feeling sorry for them.
Yeah. Did you make a little bit of money with all those animals that you trapped?
Oh, yeah. When I caught 16 lynx, they were $300-$400 a piece. I bought myself a brand new sled. I eventually even ended up buying a racing sled a year later. Cash.
And you raced.
Yeah, and I raced. I was open champion all across for 3 years in a row until the liquid cools came along. And then after that, I gave it up. I didn't want to get killed.
Right. Right.
I was crazy on a sled. I was a little nuts on a sled. I didn't want to get hurt. So
right.
I didn't race too much after that. It was too expensive.
Right.
I got into other things.
Right. And I'm curious now. I want to go back just for, because we're about to hit in about 2 minutes our 60-minute mark here. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe I would just go back to one more thing from your earlier childhood that I wanted to ask you about. And it was really about your friends. Like, who were your friends and what kinds of relationships did you have with your friends?
Basically, my friends were my cousins because we grew up together. You hung out with them all the time. I mean, you spent all summer with them. And
mm-hmm.
then you kind of looked after each other in a residential school.
Yeah.
And then in town, Lawrence, I guess, was one of my better friends, Lawrence Johnson. He lived in town, but his family was very traditional. And to this day, he still is. He still loves to skin his animals and smoke fish and whatnot. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, but basically, your friends were... You made friends in a residential school, and some of them are lifelong friends. I'll see them somewhere today, 50 years later, and it's always nice to see them, you know.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But you had from other communities. And just, you created lifelong friends that way from that experience. But your closest ones were, like, I still have Don, Uncle Don. We do see each other quite often.
Uh-huh.
Son lets us out in different ways. And then I've lost some good friends due to cancer and stuff, you know, people that I've worked with.